This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk.
Hi, my name's Chris Scott and I'm here with Steve Ray from Bevology Inc. How are you, mate?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me, Chris.
Excellent. So what we're going to be talking about today, you've got a new book coming out, I understand.
I do. Actually, it's not coming out. It has come out.
It's launched!
Officially launched today here at Wine to Wine in Verona.
Lovely, lovely. What's the book about?
Well, the title of the book is How to Get U.S. Market Ready, and it's got an interesting backstory. Stevie Kim, who is kind of the force behind Wine to Wine and also Vin Italy, and I have known each other for a long time and talked about working together on something. We never found anything to work on until now, and she came up with the idea of saying, we're going to write a book. And then she said to me, you're going to write a book, and we'll publish it together. Lovely. And that's what we did. And the whole focus of the book is for the benefit of export wine and spirit producers who are looking to enter and grow in the U.S. market. So we call it a how-to book because it's exactly that. This is not a reference book, nor is it the kind of read that you're going to stay up in the middle of the night while you're reading in bed. But it's a great book to consult for how to do the specific things that are absolutely critical and mandatory for being successful in the U.S.
Okay, so this is a book that's really geared towards the trade a little bit, isn't it?
Yes.
You know, your average consumer is not going to be looking at how to break into the U.S. market with their wine.
And interestingly, I originally wrote it for an audience of the kind of people I do consulting for. And they need some basics, but at the end of the day, there's a lot of people in America who could benefit from it as well. And the reason why is, as our industry grows, we call it beverage alcohol industry as opposed to the drinks industry.
Is that why your company's called Bevology?
Yes. Well, Beverage. Also we thought it was a cute name.
Okay.
Anyway, and my import company is Bevology Imports. So the idea is there's a lot of people in the U.S. that are coming into the wines and spirits market, but they don't get and they never had the training that many older people like me had coming in. And so there's a lot they don't know, everything from jargon to what things mean, and also not only what things mean, but what do they really mean and how does it fit in to this conundrum that is the U.S. three-tier system.
Well, that's what I want to talk about today is the U.S. three-tier system and a little bit about some of the idiosyncrasies of the market. I run a business called 3050. We do wine tastings. We set up that business in Australia as a prelude to going into the U.S. market. And we set it up in Australia. It ran quite well. We shut it down because we couldn't. We found we were competing with wineries and there was problems with the market. We made money out of the industry, but it wasn't worth the effort for the amount of money we made. And then when we went to look at the U.S. market, we just went jeepers creepers. It's so hard because we're a type of business that you either go national or you go home because it's a volume-based business to make it worthwhile. And we just looked at it and went, distribution is such a nightmare, absolute nightmare for us. You know, interstates, shipping wines, all that sort of stuff. Because in the UK, we use a hub and spoke type of system. And when we looked at that in the U.S. market, it became quite difficult to do what we wanted to do.
You're not the first ones. You're not even middle of the line.
In fact,
I realize you're a Kiwi, but an Australian parallel story is you're probably familiar with Vino Mofo, is a fabulous e-commerce startup by a couple of very creative guys. And the last place they're going to end up going to is the U.S. for exactly that reason. Their system can work in every other country, I think, in the world, except the United States.
Yeah. Okay, so let's just talk about, people talk about this famous three-tier system. Mm-hmm. What are the tiers?
Okay, well, we'll go back about 85 years, or exactly 85 years. It was the end of Prohibition. The federal government had just gone through 13 years of guys like Al Capone running the business and people running around shooting each other and all that. And so the government's goal was to establish a market that is controlled. So what they did was they established rules and regulations for the actual manufacture of products that's done by the federal government. But the actual commercial sales was given to the individual states. So we have 50 states in the U.S. We also have Washington, D.C., and we have Montgomery County, Maryland. So, in fact, we have 52 different regulatory entities. And I like to say we're more balkanized than the Balkans. So to answer your question about the three tier, the first tier is the supplier, either the manufacturer or, in the case of an imported good, an importer.
Yep.
The second, and their job is to bring it into the country and put it into a place where it's a big warehouse and it's stacked on pallets.
And can that be any, like, does it have to be in each individual state or can it be just in one central hub?
No. So an importer license is issued by the federal government and it's called a TTB import license. TTB stands for Tax and Trade Bureau, emphasis on the first word,
tax,
which is what the government was interested in when they set up these rules and regulations
for sure.
in the first place. Okay, and then the second tier is called distributors. They buy it from the supplier, but they cannot sell it directly to a consumer. Instead, they have to sell it to what we call an on- or off-premise retailer. You would call it a, I don't know what you call retail stores, but horeca in the business. Hotel, restaurant, cafe is on-premise for us. Bars and restaurants is what that means. And then in turn, they sell it to the consumers. And so we have individual retail stores, bars, restaurants, and all the variations that there are. The laws were set up so that each tier could not compete with the other tier. Over 85 years, it's more gray than black anymore. And while there really is nobody who can do importing and retail sales, there's been some overlap between distribution and importing and suppliers on one end.
Yeah.
And on the other end, not so much with distributors and retail.
You said that the importers or suppliers are federal level, so they can bring their wines into anywhere in the U.S. The distributors, are they based in each individual state? Or I think you can get distributors now who can cover multiple states. Is that right?
Well, here's where it gets complicated. A distribution license is issued by a state. That doesn't mean that a distributor only can or has to work in that state. And what's happened is the marketplace has changed radically, in fact, diametrically opposite of where it was 20 years ago. Now it's dominated by two large players. One is called Southern Glazer's Wine and Spirits, and the second is called RNDC, Republic National Distributing Company, Breakthrough, and they're, I think, going to come up with another name. But between the two of them, they own 55% of the market. And what that effectively means is it's closed the front door to the U.S. market to anybody who isn't already established here or is such a big player that they can dance with those big guys. That's not to say that those big guys don't work with little guys. They do. But the opportunities for smaller brands who want to come to the U.S. don't go through the front door. You have to look for alternative ways of entering the market and being smart rather than trying to buy your way into the system.
Okay, I think I understand what you're saying. So it's hard for, you know, English wines are now trying to export into the U.S. or some of the producers are doing that.
I was at Knight Timber. That's one of the great producers.
Yeah, another one is Rathfinney, who've set their main export target as the U.S. market. So what would their process be in terms of trying to get their wines distributed in the U.S., given that they don't have any sort of history in terms of exporting into the U.S. market?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the reasons I wrote the book is because anytime there's a question like this, my response is, how much time do you have? Because it's going to take us at least an hour and a half to explain it. So in the case of importing, importing, there are 10 distinct options for coming to the U.S. And what I counsel the people I consult for is, let's look through all of those 10 options and figure out which is the right one for you. In most cases, people in Europe have this impression, and we call it the traditional agency brand importer.
Yep.
They sell their wine to the importer. The winery, or the importer, takes over all responsibility from it from that point in terms of marketing it, selling it. That's what's changed, because nobody wants to do agency brands anymore. They want to own the brands. Why would you want to import a brand, invest your money to build it, only to have somebody take it away because they own it? And the real driver of that was Yellowtail, which really completely turned over the U.S. market. And the people who imported Deutsch set up this system where they would only work with brands where they had at least equal investment in.
I thought Yellowtail was the Caserta family?
Caserta family in partnership with Deutsch.
Oh, it was a partnership.
That was the deal. So it, you know, wasn't really significant. In fact, the woman who developed the label for it was paid a one-time fee of $5,000.
Yeah.
That's what happened. Well, I won't even go there. But the point being, the agency brand model is no longer there. There are 9 other options. They're all terrible from the perspective of a winery or a spirit company. But those are your options, and you got to figure out what's the way to work through it. And I think an analogy is probably the best way to think about it. I think about the U.S. market as a sequence of three locked gates with a brick wall at the end. All right. So the first gate that you have to unlock is the importer. The second gate that you need to unlock is the distributor. The third is the on and off premise retailer. And then at the end is this big brick wall, which is consumers who are the ones who are ultimately going to buy it. So when people come to me and say, I'm looking for an importer, they're really saying, I want to go through the first lock gates. What they're not saying is, and I recognize there's two more gates and a brick wall I have to go through. Why I wrote the book and how I counsel people is let's think through the whole process and figure out what's the right way for you to come to this market. And I'll give you one example of somebody I spoke to just in Bartolino, about a half hour away from here. He was a biodynamic producer of Bartolino. He only had 500 cases to export. He did not need an importer. He needed a customer. So I put him in touch with, it turned out it was an e-commerce wine company that specializes in hard-to-find wines or wines that aren't commercially available anywhere else, and he sold it all in one lot. So he didn't need an importer because they took care of that. He didn't need a distributor because they took care of that, and they were the retailer. For him, that was the perfect situation.
Yep.
If you're a Pinot Grigio producer and intent on selling a million cases, it's not going to work for you.
Yeah.
So you need to look for other options.
Okay. So, all right. Now, that sort of makes sense. What about in the U.S.? I've just been to a presentation where they were talking about direct to consumers, and this was the winery selling direct to consumers. Now, I understand there's all sorts of weird rules about wineries selling direct to consumers. You can sell within your state, but you can't sell outside your state, or what's going on there?
Let me simplify it for you. We'll define that as interstate between states,
yeah,
and intrastate within the state. Right now, the only legal way to bypass the three-tier system is for domestic suppliers who are empowered by the federal government to sell directly to consumers. Everybody else has to go through the three-tier system. So if you're an imported product, that door is not open to you yet or now. I think because the power of e-commerce and the internet is going to knock down all the pilings under the pier of beverage alcohol in America, that will change in the future. But right now it's not. So what we're seeing is in California, as an example, producers producing under 5,000 cases per year. The latest numbers from Silicon Valley Bank report, and I would urge your readers to get a copy of the SVB State of the Industry, 80% of their business goes direct to consumer. Now, whether it's from wine clubs, people who visited the winery, or variations on the theme, they can't afford to go through traditional distribution. The conundrum is this. Every winery here in Europe or anywhere I travel is, they say, how come everybody else is making more money on my wine than I am? And the rule of thumb we use is for export brands, if you multiply your ex-seller price by 4, you'll get close to a U.S. price. So if you're selling $4 wine, and you have to own a winery, and you have to do all the vinification and the labors and the insurance and the risk and all that, and if you go down, you know, importer marks it up, distributor marks it up, retailer marks it up, the distributor is generally making more money on the wine than the winery, and they're not making the wine.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just the way it is. So the issue is, learn the structure, find ways that work for you. And the whole reason that I wrote the book was exactly that. It's many ways of navigating within a labyrinth. There is no one path because everybody's situation is different. So three-tier system is it seems more complex than it actually is. Everything can be simplified, but it all requires somebody being smart enough or prepared enough to think their way through it before they take the first step.
Okay. It's quite interesting because a lot of people think of America as being quite a competitive market, but I actually often hear lots of stories, whether it be agriculture, wine, whatever, where it's really just it's really not a very competitive market at all. There's subsidies left, right, and center. There's monopoly profits left, right, and center. You know, business wants, everybody says, oh, about business, oh, I want to have competition. What they really mean is I want to have competition for other people. I want a monopoly to make monopoly rents.
Well stated.
Yeah. and in America, you look at it and you go, there's a lot of people making monopoly rents. This cannot be an open competitive market.
Well, I think a couple of things. You have to separate the wine business from the spirits business, because the wine business is by definition an agricultural business. Mm-hmm. And so it does involve and respond to some of the issues you're talking. In California, wine production is a very big part of the economy, and so they have regulations and rules in California that aren't really relevant or applicable, of course, to any other states. So yes, there's the agricultural component, but I think each state is different. There are solutions for every brand in every state. One mistake a lot of people make is, I want to come to the U.S. And if they're not going to be selling a lot of wine, you don't want to come to the U.S. You want to pick one market. Because if you're going to sell 3,000 cases, you can sell all 3,000 cases in St. Louis.
Yeah.
You don't need to sell it in 50 states and deal with 50 distributors and 50 different set of legal regulations and 50 different labels and 50 different sets of inventory. It's foolish. But people think of the U.S. as one entity. And a friend of ours once expressed this very, very well, I thought. He said, don't think you can paint the states that one size fits all or that it works. The reality is you need to think your way through the market and pick the ones that are best for you.
I think it might have been you I was talking to earlier or someone else, but I was saying that we think of Europe being Brexit at the moment, but let's not worry about that. But we think of Europe as individual countries.
Yep.
But because of the EU and the way they've designed their market, it's actually probably more closer to a single country, and particularly in terms of wine, than the US. Because if I'm a wine shop, I can go to France to a supplier, I can buy a pallet of wine in France, bring it back into my shop, and sell it straight away. There's no problems. I think the EU market, even though it's individual countries, is actually more of a country.
Absolutely.
Than the American, which is more of an individual state.
Well, so the concept of the EU, as I understand it, and looking at 3,000 years of European history, is they finally got together. And roughly in population size, it's pretty close to the U.S. We're at 350 million. I think you're maybe 325 or something like that. I don't know what it is. But, no borders. It's a European community. And even if you're not a member of the EU itself, you benefit from it. And we're seeing a lot of Eastern European countries come in. And yet there's still countries, I don't even know, is Sweden part of the EU officially? In some part? Well, they have a monopoly system that's regulated by them. So what you said is true, except for Sweden, Norway, and Finland. So that's kind of like the U.S. in that regard. But yes, it is much, much simpler in the U.S., in Europe. The other impact that the EU has on the U.S. is, since it's an agricultural product, is providing funds, which they term OCM funds. I don't know what it stands for. It's probably something in French because it's there in Belgium, right? But it's promotional funds. And there's a lot of that money that is being spent and, shall we say, could be spent more wisely for the benefit of the individual producers from the EU as a whole, or any individual country, or any individual region. And I use Verona right here in Italy as an example. It's kind of hard to promote Verona as a region because people buy Valpolicella.
Yep.
Or they buy a brand of Valpolicella. Mm. And it's only recently that Americans have been buying more branded wines than varietal wines. If you asked an American 10 years ago, what kind of wine do you drink? They might say Cabernet Sauvignon or Chardonnay or something like that. Mm. And then if you went and asked them, have you ever tried Bordeaux? They'd say, no, I only drink Cabernet Sauvignon or I only drink Merlot. They didn't know that those varietals were part of those geographically defined names. We've come around not 180 degrees, but 270 degrees in that now brands have taken over. The Prisoner, the Federalist, Little Black Dress. There's a whole bunch of brands that have been created. And I think here's a really interesting story. I hope you have time for this because this is a really good one. There was a brand that was developed by this serial wine entrepreneur in California called The Prisoner. He built it to roughly 20,000 cases. Sold it to a gentleman by the name of Agustin Junius, who's legendary in the global wine business, owns a bunch of properties in Chile. He's Chilean. And he bought it, 20,000 cases for $40 million. He sold it 4 years later. He was selling 170,000 cases, so not even 10X, okay? And he sold it for $280 million. So what I do is I track sales like that based on dollars per cases sold at that current moment. Mm-hmm. And he increased the value of his product from $400 or whatever it was when he bought it to $4,000 when he sold it. And here's the big irony. There is no winery. There is no vineyards.
Yeah.
There is no physical anything. It is nothing more than an ephemeral brand. It's a name.
Yeah, yeah.
And he did, and he, you know, I mean, that's better than investment banking, right? So it can be done. And I think the direction where the world is going, our world, and I think Europe, the rest of the world as well, is brands are significant. And then new categories like Prosecco, Rosé, Moscato, and what's next? I don't know. Yeah. We'll find out.
Moscato.
Oh, yeah.
In the U.S.
Absolutely.
Moscato d'Este, like the sweet sparkling.
No. Moscato, as in Muscat Alexandria.
Yeah, yeah, okay, the grape variety. The aromatic.
Yeah, because it's an aromatic grape. But it's also sweet, and that ties in with Moscato made Prosecco possible. You could not have gotten to Prosecco because Moscato made it okay for Americans to drink sweet. These new branded wines, like the big one is called Apothic, by Gallo, and another one which just completely took over the market. They have, I'm guessing, 12 grams of residual sugar.
Oh, okay.
I would taste a wine like that, and I would not enjoy it. I don't like wines with that much residual sugar. But we're Americans. We grew up on Coca-Cola.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
We like sweet. We talk dry, but we drink sweet.
Yeah, white Zinfandel.
Yeah, so you get – well, but not even that. I mean, that's rosé today, right, at 10 times the price. But if you give an American a glass of Prosecco and a glass of Dom Perignon, they'll appreciate the Prosecco better simply because there's more sugar in it.
Oh, okay. Maybe, maybe not, though, because we run tastings and we give people, you know, decent fizz, decent champagne, and we give them decent Prosecco, and we don't tell them which one's which or anything like that. We just say, which one do you prefer? And it's pretty much down the center. Some prefer Prosecco, and this is a dry Prosecco, not the sweet Prosecco, because we don't tend to do that.
Brut. Yeah, but even so, Brut can go up to 12.
Oh, yeah, but the acidity hides it, so you don't really know. It doesn't come across as a sweet drink. And really is. Half the people prefer champagne, half the people prefer Prosecco, because not everybody likes those yeast-driven styles of wine. Some people like a fruit-driven style of sparkling wine. I like a fruit-driven style of sparkling wine. I like a yeasty style. I like more wine, to be honest. Yeah. I can't tell people I'm a flexible drinker. So people, it may not necessarily be the sweetness. It might be that those yeasty styles of sparkling wines aren't always what people are looking for and they actually like. If you tell them it's champagne, it's very expensive, then their brains will go, oh, I like that more. But if they don't know what it is, a lot of people prefer fruit-driven styles of sparkling wine.
I hear you. I disagree.
Okay.
And I'm speaking for America alone. And because champagne has always been a bigger part of the UK culture, historically and currently, especially now making your domestic wines, it has never been that big. It was strictly a holiday and celebratory thing. People, the vast majority of wine consumers, did not drink what you call champagne. We would call American sparkling wine made in the traditional manner with the second fermentation in the bottle. They saved it for special times. Prosecco came along. It's the big brand was La Marca from Gallo. It's got 17 grams of residual sugar. It's right on the edge of extra dry, but they don't label it either Brut or extra dry. People taste that and say, wow, this is great. I could drink this every day. It's sweet and it's got a nice acid balance, and that's all you need to know. And so what it has done is made sparkling wine an everyday drink,
yeah.
And it could never have happened unless Moscato and some of these other sweeter things had come in beforehand to allow people to say, yes, I like sweeter wine. And I think that's a big difference between UK and US.
Yeah, maybe. Okay. Yeah,
you disagree with me. That's good.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Well, I don't know the US market that well, so, you know.
Fair enough.
I think that a lot of people, when they start drinking wines, they often start out at white wines with a little bit of residual sugar in them because it makes it more palatable. It makes it more easy to drink. And then quite often you see people move to a drier style white wine, and then they'll move to a redder style with lower tannins, and then eventually they'll embrace the tannins and everything and they'll get into it. So perhaps it's more, these sweeter styles are like a gateway drug to
well,
to the more...
To a degree.
The more, but what some people would say is more serious.
The research that I see, and nobody can predict the future, is it counters that and basically says the millennial generation is redefining America's taste in wine, and the industry is now adapting to the millennial. What's going to happen in 10 years? It's going to be different. I don't know what, but I don't think there is this repeated linear correlation from sweet to dry. I think people are going to stop on the way, and they're also going to have different types of wines with different levels of sweetness that they want, or complexity, at different occasions. It's a very occasion-driven thing, whether or not it's with food or without. The other point, I think, is there's a lot of talk in the wine industry about food pairing, and I think we as an industry do ourselves a disservice. I don't have the research to document this, but I know this to be true. Americans want to know two things about a bottle of wine. What does it taste like in words that I understand? And will it go with what I'm having for dinner tonight? Because 80% of what's bought in America is consumed within 24 hours.
Right? With food or just consumed?
Consumed. Not necessarily the food, but the idea being, if you give them the answer of this tastes like, and I'm not talking about fried gooseberries that have been, you know, shoveled over with leather, and you know, I don't know what a gooseberry is, much less a fried one. But if you say, use terms that they understand and people are getting to recognize bright red fruits crisp, citrusy type things for Sauvignon Blanc, okay? Those are words that people can relate to and understand. When we use wine geek speak, people just turn off. And what's happening is there's been this kind of decomplification, if that's a word, of wine. And these new branded wines have allowed people, they don't care what the varieties are. This one could be Grenache. This one could be Cabernet Sauvignon. This one could be a blend. It could be a traditional Bordeaux blend or something entirely different. It doesn't matter.
To be honest, I'm actually sort of pleased about that because I think there's been too much snobbery against sort of these semi-sweet wines. You know, there's a case to say that...
By whom, though? That's the point.
Oh, the wine trade.
Yes, agreed.
Wine trade. Yeah. And I think the reason... people in the wine trade did it was because they saw pink, white Zinfandel as sort of a cheap glugging type of thing. And also people who know about wine know that the easiest way to hide poor quality grapes is to make a slightly sweet style of wine. So you can have low quality potential wines, but make it appealing to the consumer by having it semi-sweet. So a lot of people who are wine geeks immediately start thinking, no, this has got to be rubbish, without actually enjoying the stuff. Like one of my favorite wines is a Moscato d'Asti.
Yeah.
I like Moscato d'Asti. You know, I like the alcohol. It's 5.5% sort of thing. You can drink two bottles of it today. It's fabulous
and
stuff.
It's got a little sparkle, which makes it even nicer.
Yeah.
And that's wonderful after dinner because the sparkles and the acid, it's got some reasonable acid, clears the palate, and it's a wonderful thing. But that's such – and I love it too. We used to import a brand that was one of my favorites. But so my feeling is let people drink what they want.
Yeah.
Today, with social media, what has fundamentally changed? People today don't care what the pundits say. They want to know what their peers say. And that's why social media and sharing and discovery and things like VinePair have really exploded in the U.S. because it's available to everybody, easily available at, you know, in everybody's hand, all this information, where you only used to be able to get that at a store, you know, with a salesman. Now you don't even have to go to a store. You can buy it in e-commerce, interstate as well as intrastate. Here's the numbers. Intrastate, you can sell wine from a retailer to a consumer in about 39, 42 states, depending on how legal you want to be. Interstate, between states, there's only 14 states that allow that.
Okay, then, Steve, I think we're going to wrap it up there.
Thank you for having me.
Not a problem. And next week we'll continue on this really interesting story.
I look forward to it.